Good morning, everyone, and welcome to a special edition of A Vision for You. Today is Sunday, May 10, 2026. My name is Leah M., recovered compulsive overeater, and I'm your moderator for this morning. The share ID numbers for Friday, May 8th, are the following. For the 7 a.m. Eastern Big Book Study, 23,443. That's 2, 3, 4. And for the 10 a.m. Eastern Big Book Study, 23,444. That's 2, 3, 4, 4, 4. This morning, A Vision for You presents No More Bright Lights. In step one, we conceded powerlessness, the realization that we are doomed. In our disease of compulsive overeating, we found a sense of complete despair. We cannot solve the problem of compulsive overeating by ourselves. Effective on our own power. Our personal history of suffering has demonstrated that fact, not just with respect to compulsive overeating, but also with regard to unmanageability. To living a quality life. We finally realized, after enough pummeling, that anything that comes from our own resources, meaning our will, our effort, our self-knowledge, philosophies, morality, goals, or our very good intentions, won't solve our problem. Our human resources alone simply aren't sufficient. Thus begins our desperate and deliberate search for an effective relationship with power. Since this power, this fundamental idea of God, is deep down inside of us, what exactly is preventing us from an effective relationship with it? What prevents us from improving our conscious contact with God? Our book says it may be obscured by calamity, by pomp, or by worship of other things. Things such as people, or various schemes, relationships, money, vanity, methods, just to name a few. These impediments ensure continued deterioration and darkness, blocking us from the sunlight of the Spirit. Joining us today to speak on this topic is Rena L., a recovered compulsive overeater from Ohio. Rena is dedicated to our 12-step way of life, and she's here to share her experience, strength, and hope with all of us this morning. It's with great appreciation that I welcome Rena to the line this morning. Good morning, Rena.
Good morning. My name is Rena L., and I'm a recovered compulsive overeater. This talk is going to be about all kinds of bright lights, the ones I've chased, the ones I've performed under, the ones I stared into at 3 a.m. when I couldn't stop eating, and what happened very slowly, when I stopped needing them. It's been an ongoing spiritual experience of the educational variety, as it is said in the back of the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, which I'll get to. I'll start with a little bit about me. I want to pause and admit that when I was asked a few weeks ago to speak today, I really wanted to say no. I did a talk last June on the special edition and another one about a year before that, and I didn't want to contribute to the problem of hearing the same speakers and the same messages. And I didn't want people to be bored hearing parts of my story again, or worse, for you all to think I was showing off. And then, of course, I paused and remembered that I agreed at the beginning of this journey to say yes to do service if I was available, but also that to say no would have been more my ego, more my lack of humility than anything else. And so what I came to was that at least one of you must need to hear something in my story. So maybe it's you. I don't know. You may have similarities to parts of my backstory, my story. You may not. Either way, I encourage you to focus on whether you've ever had similar feelings or patterns. My first word was cookie. It's documented in my baby book. My first sentence, I want a cookie. I spent my childhood alone in our basement with fake wood paneling, watching Bozo the Clown on the TV with rabbit ears. I was covered in crumbs, living in food and TV fantasy while a full house went on above me. Puberty hit early. My body changed, seemed overnight, and my mom started putting me on diets. I'm probably going to curse twice during this. It might be more. My goal is not going to be more, not more than that. But I became what I can only describe as fuck you fat. If you're gonna tell me what I can and can't eat, I'm going to eat what I want. I'm going to drink what I want. I'm going to do what I want. I was going to say what I want. I was a punk, big punk kid in the 80s, pretending very convincingly I thought that I didn't care. Down deep, I couldn't look at myself below the neck in the mirror, and I felt I couldn't say no to anyone about anything, and I took what I can get. After getting all D's and F's and getting kicked out of schools, I realized I was going to be stuck living at home if I didn't do something different. So like any good addict, I went from D's and F's to straight A's. In junior year of high school, my mom called. Oh, sidebar right there. Some of you may not be old enough to remember the days before cell phones, when my mom had to call the school office, then the office sent someone to my classroom to come physically get me and bring me back to the office to talk to my mom on the phone. And she called to ask permission to open something else that shows my age, an envelope, and exercising remarkably good boundaries at that point in our relationship. And it turned out that I'd gotten into a competitive college that no one expected me to get into, given my history of D's and F's. And she proposed we celebrate at my favorite restaurant, where all I ever really wanted was the flaming desserts. But I snapped back, why do I always have to celebrate with food? I still to this day don't know like why I said that, and I didn't know that that was going to be my first bout of anorexia. I don't remember deciding to lose weight. I just know that as my size got smaller, the compliments were intense. We always knew there was a pretty girl underneath all that. I hated every one of them, and I desperately wanted more of them at the same time. By the time I left for college, I was dangerously underweight. The resident advisor on my dorm floor was astonished my mom left me at school. As it's Mother's Day, I just want to note that it is a miracle of the 12 steps that I have such a beautiful relationship with my mom today. And she later admitted, as a result of an amends conversation we had, that she couldn't see how sick I was because she was so relieved and proud that I finally lost weight. You all know what happens next. The binging eventually came back, then the restriction, then the binging. The cycle ran for years. And by law school, I had given up on anything but the library, alcohol, and food. My peers voted me most likely to die in a Chris Farley-like fashion. If you are much older or much younger than me, you may need to look up the reference on the internet. The thing is, my law school peers weren't wrong. A couple years on, a long relationship ended. And that's when the floor went out entirely. I went to the convenience store in my lobby at the time and bought a jug of vodka and a carton of cigarettes. I stopped eating and I started going out every night. Downtown Chicago bars, South Beach and Vegas nightclubs, eventually way darker places than bars and nightclubs. I dropped 9 sizes. I went from Lane Bryant to children's sizes and I thought I had arrived. I was thin, finally, and working at the largest firm in the country and not thinking about food. The thing is, I was blacking out almost every day, waking up in strange places. And here's the truth about what kind of compulsive eater I am, and I say it in almost every lead to remind myself about who I really am. I regularly chose going home with a stranger over risking going home alone and binging on food in a blackout. That's how afraid I was of myself. There was no me between work and bars, and my life fit into a shot glass. The end of that chapter was not a bright light. It was the opposite. One night I'd been in a nightclub, wall-to-wall people, strobe light, bass you feel in your chest, everyone performing their best version of having a great time. And I was getting kicked out for passing cocaine out in the bathroom. I don't remember most of it. What I remember later is my bathroom, bottles around me on the floor, and in the mirror, something I had been successfully avoiding for a long time. I saw someone who was not okay. The longer I'm in recovery, the sadder this makes me. I was emaciated and covered in bruises with a bloody nose and hair falling out. And I had constructed my life so that no one could see this. It meant no one was coming to save me. I didn't have a flashing bright light moment of wanting to get sober, let alone abstinent. I just wanted to get help with my heart racing and skipping and help with constant dehydration. I couldn't find my wallet, so I couldn't jump in a cab. This is pre-Uber days. And I just started walking, hoping to get to a hospital. I somehow ended up instead getting too tired to continue walking, hilariously and painfully still in high heels from the night before. And I landed in front of what I later learned was a recovery home. The story of how I got sober and clean, which will be 23 years next week, which is a miracle, is a story for another fellowship. But note that there was no burning bush, no moment of blinding clarity, but walking in off the street because I'd run out of other options. But getting sober didn't solve the food. Without the substances, the binging was catastrophic. It was round the clock to the point of pain, begging whoever was listening to either take the urge or take me off this planet. And then the people in that other fellowship sent me to OA. It didn't work at first. But alcohol had allowed me to keep a secret that I was alone in crowded, flashing light nightclubs. Food allowed me to keep a secret that I was alone when I was actually alone with the flashing lights of the TV. I thought food was the only thing that really knew me. Then I got to OA and I made so many close friends. In fact, right now, I live in Ohio, but I'm in Chicago this week. I leave after this week. I've been here the past few days. And I've had nonstop dates with friend after friend that I met over 20 years ago in those first meetings. I don't know if you've noticed, but before this point in my story, you haven't heard me mention any friends. If nothing else happened to me in OA, it was more than enough. But eventually the all-day and all-night binging stopped and I found some recovery. And then I'd lose it. At least 6 times over, I think, 18 years or so, I ran the same cycle. Surrender, work the steps, get abstinent, life gets extraordinary, and I start letting my disease creep in without realizing it. Smaller adjustments, lighter choices, more exercise. I don't need to do X or Y anymore. And then my weight drops, and I don't notice, or I won't let myself. And then 2 years of anorexia I can barely remember. And then, of course, that breaks, and I go back to binging. Around-the-clock binging, canceling plans, becoming a shut-in until I lose everything. Rinse, wash, repeat. The last relapse was the worst. Ugh. What's different now? A new sponsor from this meeting who texted me that she's listening, so hello. Working the steps out of the big book, committing to do things I've been refusing for years. A nutritionist who has my weight data and I don't. It goes to her. She tells me what to adjust. I do it. No cycling. Outreach called even when I have nothing to say. I have been weight stable for longer than any other period in my life, including in so-called abstinence. I sponsor, I pray and meditate. Most importantly, as I said in a talk on this line about 2 years ago, my training wheels don't come off. What I did on day one, I do today. When I talk about not needing the bright lights anymore, I'm talking about spending decades manufacturing them because I was terrified of the dark. All right, now I'll tell you about bright lights. The first one I remember clearly, I'm 13 years old, my name is up in lights, and a party so lavish that the bartender who served me my first vodka asked me if it was a benefit for Liberace. No, I told him, this was my effing life. I use the actual word, but I'm trying to minimize my cursing here. I was ashamed about my name up in lights and the entire event, but also, again, some part of me desperately craved and loved it. And when it was over, I went back to being the girl in the basement with the fake wood paneling and the crumbs and the television and feeling the strange loneliness of having just been celebrated. Then there were the nightclubs, South Beach nightclubs since I was 14 years old, downtown Chicago, New York, Vegas. The way darkness strove with light makes everybody look glamorous, even me. I was in my element, performing a version of myself that was audacious and didn't care and was having the time of my life. The lights helped. The lights made it easier not to look too closely what was actually going on. Then there was the bright light of achievement. Straight A's after years of nearly failing out, a competitive law college, a top law firm, awards at law school graduation where I took a shot at Southern Comfort each time I walked to the podium so I'd look humble instead of what I actually was, a girl who desperately needed the room to know she had made it despite everything they'd assumed about her. The recognition felt like light. And then there was a different kind of bright light. The blue-white glow of a television screen at 2 in the morning and 3 in the morning and 4. The television on because I couldn't be alone in the dark with myself. The refrigerator door open, the fluorescent haze of it. If you've been in our disease binging at that hour, you know what I mean. That life isn't glorious, but it is a kind of brightness. For a period of my disease, even in programs, spin class, high intensity everything, the strobe effect they sometimes use in cycling studios, deliberate, manufactured intensity, and the feeling of going somewhere where I wasn't actually going anywhere at all. The performance of being the person who shows up before dawn and pushes hard and earns her place in the world through sheer effort. Every single one of these bright lights was at its core the same thing, a way to feel real, a way to feel like I existed and mattered and wasn't the girl alone in the basement. A way to be seen, to be validated, to not have to trust that I was okay with my darkness. My disease is a bright light chaser. Whether I was binging or restricting or performing or achieving or spinning, I was doing the same thing. I was trying to generate enough light that I wouldn't have to sit in the uncertainty of just being alive without knowing if I was enough. All right, now I get to the big one. When I came into recovery, really came in, I can't believe I'm sticking to this outline. Okay. Look at me praising myself in front of, I don't know how many people are listening, but I really came in the time that is stuck. I was desperate. I had run out of options and strategies. I was on my knees in a way I had never been before. And I did all the things. I got a sponsor. I worked the steps. I did the non-negotiables I thought were insane. The food plan, the outreach calls I made when I had nothing to say, to practice for the moment when I would, and I waited for the bright light. I had heard people talk about spiritual awakening, and I was quietly certain that I was going to be one of the exceptions. Not because I wasn't willing. I was, finally. But because I generally could not make myself believe. I couldn't manufacture faith. I had tried. I had looked at sunrises and oceans and thought, okay, time to feel God. But I felt nothing except that the sunrise was pretty and I was cold. So I kept waiting for the moment when it would hit me. The unmistakable, undeniable bright light of spiritual experience. The thing people described in meetings that made me feel like either they're lying or I'm broken. And it never came. I'm going to pause and read page 567 of the big book, fourth paragraph, second sentence. Most of our experiences are what the psychologist William James calls the educational variety because they develop slowly over a period of time. Quite often, friends of the newcomer are aware of the difference long before he is himself. He finally realizes that he has undergone a profound alteration in his reaction to life, that such a change could hardly have been brought about by himself alone. What often takes place in a few months can seldom have been accomplished by years of self-discipline. With few exceptions, our members find they have tapped an unsuspected inner resource, which they presently identify with their own conception of a power greater than themselves. Okay. I didn't feel God. I hear people say they don't want to act as if because they're done pretending and wearing masks. The thing is, I'm not talking about playing a part for others to see me in a certain way. It's taking action to change how I see the world. I started to talk to something I wasn't sure was there. I started praying, not because I believe prayer worked, but because it changed what I was doing with my mind at that moment. I started to trying to create the traits I associated with spiritual people. Trust, openness, a willingness not to be the one in charge of the outcome. But I was nearly certain that I'm doing something pointless. And still something shifted. Not dramatically, not in a way I could point to and say, there, that's when it happened. More like the way your eyes adjust to a room after the lights go out. You don't feel it happening. You just gradually realize you can see more than you could before. I don't know if God is real. I'm at peace with not knowing. What I know is that I need the God idea. And I found that if I act as if I show up and talk to the mystery and practice radical trust, my life functions differently. I function differently. I'm grateful to someone from program who helped me build a God idea that for today works for me. A while back, I lost a motion in court that would leave a family who lost their sole wage provider with nothing. My clients were devastated. I was devastated. And I felt the old thing rise up in my belly. Rage. Certainty that the world was wrong and I had to fix it. The fury of someone who needs everything to go the way she needs it to go. I have a long history with that feeling. The last time I felt something like it, I was binging over it in seconds. But this time, I'd been making those outreach calls even when I had nothing to say. I'd been practicing. So I picked up the phone and said, "Can I talk through a 10 step?" And I did. And then the random woman I called asked, "What's your spiritual truth about the situation?" I took a deep breath. What came was this: I'm just a chess piece. I'm not the one running the board. I don't know where all the other pieces need to go, what moves need to happen, what the larger game requires. Maybe winning an appeal on this matters more than winning this motion. Maybe my clients need something I can't provide and someone else will. Maybe I need this humility right now for reasons I can't see yet. I don't know, and I don't have to know. I get to be a chess piece, doing my little part and trusting that who or whatever is running the board is smarter and more loving than I can arrange. I was immediately free. So, update, I just took that issue to the Supreme Court this past March, and I won't know the outcome till sometime either this month or next month. I'm certainly checking my email every morning. I don't know the outcome, but for today, I am remarkably and strangely, for someone like me, at peace about it. No bright light. That's my spiritual awakening. Not a moment, just a practice, a decision I keep making. I don't care anymore whether God is real in a philosophical way. I know that the God idea is necessary for me. And I know that if I create the conditions and show up to the conversation, something that feels like grace appears. That's enough for me. I'm going to take a breath for a second. Okay. Now I'm worried if someone's just jumping on the line and they think that the call's not going on because I was actually quiet for a second, but that's probably a metaphor for how I handle life too. I still like bright lights. I still like shiny things. I travel a lot. I find joy in beautiful rooms and places and things. I have not been delivered from aesthetic pleasure. I think sometimes in recovery, we get confused about what we're supposed to be giving up. I was at a dinner recently, a nice dinner, kind with white tablecloths and people telling good stories, lawyers mostly. I was in my element, animated conversation, good company, a lovely room. I'm wearing leather jeans and high heels, another gift of recovery. And then my entree arrived. I'm going to pause. If you hear anything in this story that sounds like I'm telling you how to handle your food in restaurants, you've misheard me. I have sponsees who don't weigh and measure their food, and that's exactly right for them. I do because everything in my history tells me I need to, not because I'm more rigorous or more recovered, because without it, my history shows me over and over again where things go. Nothing else has worked for me. I don't give myself enough when I don't weigh and measure. That sets up the restriction pattern, which eventually sets up the binge pattern. Okay, back to the story. So I carry a little travel scale. It fits in my evening bag always. In that moment, as my entree arrived and the conversation was so good and I was so in the room, happy and present, I had a thought. I don't want to interrupt this. I'm almost, not quite, but almost believing my own performance of being an effortlessly elegant woman at the table who belongs here without any complicated equipment. And then, and I feel like I'm going to cry when I say this, I put my hand on the scale. And the minute I touched it, I remember who I am. I'm a recovered compulsive overeater. I can't afford to get lost in the fantasy of the bright lights. I am real. And that realness, the actual, unperformed, imperfect scale in the evening bag realness, is the most valuable thing about me. Not shrinking from the table, being actually who I am at the table without performance. A lot of things have happened at dinners like this one when I've reached for the scale. I'll tell you a couple. We'll see how the timing goes. Once a senator at the table asked what I was doing. I don't always give an explanation, but I got a nudge from the universe to just tell him. And somehow it opened a conversation, and he told me about his daughter currently in treatment for an eating disorder with tears in his eyes. And in me, he could see her life didn't have to be over. I was out in the world. I would never have had that conversation as the woman I want to be in the fantasy of bright lights. Another time, a man watched me with the scale, and we started talking, and again, the universe nudged me to sometimes, usually I do it without explanation, but once in a while, the universe nudges me otherwise. He'd been trying to help someone he loved with her own relationship with food for years. He'd never found the language. Watching me be matter of fact about my tools, my scale, not ashamed, not performing, just doing my thing, gave him something. I don't know exactly what, but it was real. Just this week, a friend I'd had lunch with regularly for 15 years, someone whose own struggle with our disease, I've watched with grief and love as she's become so large she can barely walk. And she asked me for the first time in 15 years for some details as I was measuring my food about those crazy meetings I go to. 15 years. I'm not the bright light. I'm not supposed to be. The moment I stop performing and just show up as exactly who I am with the complicated history and the scale in the evening bag, all is well. The bright lights I spent my life chasing were all at bottom ways of not trusting that I was okay in the ordinary. The bat mitzvah spotlight, the nightclub strobe light, the achievement light, the screen glow at 3 a.m. with food in my lap, the spin class intensity. Recovery for me has been learning to live in the quiet. Not because I've given up on joy. I haven't. I have more of it now than I ever did under any spotlight. But because I've stopped requiring the lights to feel real. I don't feel God in a flash. I feel God or the God idea or the great mystery or whatever the heck it is in a 10-step phone call at the moment of a lost motion, in the weight of my hand on a little scale in an evening bag, and showing up for a friend right now who's dying in a way I never could have when I was still trying to perform being okay. The big book talks about a spiritual awakening. I used to think I was too skeptical and too broken for it. Now I think my spiritual awakening has been exactly this. The slow, unremarkable, ongoing discovery that I don't need the lights, that I'm okay in the dark, that something is with me in the ordinary, in the meals I weigh and measure, in the calls I make when I have nothing to say. I just want to leave with this. I think I'm going to wrap up early. If you're someone who's still waiting for the bright light experience, the moment of total clarity, the dramatic transformation, the unmistakable sign, I'm not here to tell you it won't come for you. It might. But also, we don't have to wait for it. We don't have to manufacture it. We don't have to perform it for the people in this room. My recovery works one day at a time, one meal at a time, one phone call at a time, made when I have nothing to say to practice it for the moment when I do. My life is bigger than it has ever been, not because I finally got out of the spotlight, because I finally put down the need for it. I'm going to stop there. So that's it. I'm ready for questions. Thanks.
Rena, thank you so much for your compelling, very profound and inspiring presentation. Thank you so very much. Another gem for the archives. The share ID for today, 23,446. That's 23446. Rena's contact information will be given at the conclusion of this recording, so do stay tuned for that. And we will now transition to question and answer segment. You can pose a question to Rena. Questions only, please. By pressing star 1 to unmute, and I need your name, including the first letter of your last name.
Jason KP.
Thank you, Jason.
Maura Z.
Maura. Star 1 to unmute. Great opportunity to ask questions.
Nancy C.
Nancy, good morning.
Nick, yeah?
Hey, Nick.
Gene M.
Hello.
Gene M. Anyone else in this list? Okay, let's get started. I've got Jason, Maura, Nancy, Nick, and Jean. Jason, your question, please.
Good morning. Thank you, Jason KP from Pennsylvania. Thanks, Rena. I'm wondering if you could elaborate on keeping the training wheels on, do the same things you did when you first came in. I always had this assumption, you know, there's ebbs and flows, and the first, you know, work through the steps, you know, is a really, really intense period that can't be sustained over time. So I'd just love to hear more about that.
Mm-hmm. Thanks, Jason, for the question. I with my years and program, I would always start really strong and do all the things. And over time, I would convince myself, I don't need to do things. I don't need to do this. Okay, nothing happened. Then this and this. And suddenly it was all gone, all of it. And I didn't really know it was all gone until I was in the knee deep in an all-night binge. So I know that that is something some people say in program, like, just get through the steps. You're in the hospitalization period, and then things are different. But maybe to some other people, I live in the hospitalization period. You know, it doesn't feel like that. The more I do in program, the bigger my life gets. But whatever I committed to my sponsor is the non-negotiables to working with her that first day, I still do every day. I think there was one day I didn't, like, I kind of tried to sneak about it. And then I had, to, you know, I came like, oh my God, I'm trying to get out of this. I can't afford it. But I don't know what's right for other people. You know, even my sponsees do it differently than I do. But I know for me, with my history of relapse, that I, the only thing, like the permanence, as they say in the other OA literature, like the repetition is the permanence of my recovery. And so I do it every day. That's the best as I can explain it. Whenever I've tried to treat like program, like, oh, it's just with training wheels. And now I've been coming around long enough that I can let off the training wheels. I'm ready to walk or ride my bike without the wheels. And it turns out that's just not for me. And that might be for other people, but that's not my story. So I don't know if that's useful or not, but that's all I've got.
Thank you, Jason. Maura Z, your turn.
Thank you, Leia, for your service. And Rena, my question is, what or how did you pray when you didn't know how? Because this is my weakest link, and I don't know that I know how to pray. I don't know that what I'm doing is right because it's still my weakest link. If you would share something on that.
Sure. That's a great question. And I will acknowledge, I often say to other people that this prayer and meditation thing is definitely not my strong suit. But I do it. And someone else on this who might be listening now or might be listening to the podcast later, who knows, but it said, you know, it starts a prayer like, I don't know if you hear me. I don't know if you exist, but if you do hear me and you do, you know, please help. That is what got me started. And I still use that a lot of mornings. Sometimes I just write out a list of everything that's like weighing on me, you know, or even let's like say to my mind, like I make a list of everything that's weighing on me. I'm saying like, I just need help. Like, I just need to turn it over. A lot of times lately, I start just praying for other people. Like, I start thinking of the people that I'm worried about or who are sick or whatever it is, struggling. And I don't know if that's technically prayer, but for me, I mean, like, I don't know what it means, but I know that I'm doing it. I find using some of those, you know, daily meditation, daily reader books are helpful. Lately, I've picked up for the religious tradition I was raised in, you know, I've picked up some morning prayers from that, which has really been astonishing for me. They don't feel meaningful, like in the words, but in the sounds of it somehow, it's shifting something inside right now. So I don't think there's a wrong way to do it. I think it's just showing up and doing it over time, whatever it is. You know, I try when people talk about the 11th step or people are talking about prayer, I try to really pay attention. And sometimes I just borrow what they say. Like, I'll hear something on the meeting and I'll try that and it sometimes it sticks. Either way, I set a timer and I sit. And I know some people are like, why set a timer? Just because if not, I won't sit. History has shown if I don't set a timer, I'm jumping all over the place. So I don't know exactly how to do it, but I do it. I think about the great mystery. Sometimes I'm like praying to the mystery I don't understand. And I know that for me, I can't pray for any outcomes. I can only pray to be able to handle whatever happens because the world is disappointing. And so I don't know. So whatever I pray to, I can't pray. For me, it doesn't work to pray for a different outcome or a different world or a different set of facts. I just pray inside to like trust that I'll be able to handle whatever happens come what may. So that's my messy answer to that question. It's a good question, for sure.
Thank you, Maura. Nancy C., good morning.
Hey, good morning, Leah. Thank you for your service and everyone doing service on the line. And, oh, Rena, you never know where you're going to show up, but really, thank you for 12-stepping me today. My question is, you know, for how do you take those bright lights and dim them? And it's not, I didn't hear pridefulness in your talk, sorry about the dog, but the ability to not let that overshadow what you've so graciously been given in this program and how you put the program above everything else. You talked about it, but there's some heady things that, for me, those shiny objects would be off to the races again. And learning it, how did you learn the repetition of the training wheels can't come off and that everything has to be done if I want to live happy, joyous, and free? How you do that in your daily life when those bright lights or those shining objects really make you think maybe you've got it this time? Thanks, and I pass.
Thank you. It's good to hear your voice this morning. It's a good question also. They're all good questions. You know, my history, I have a healthy fear of relapse. My disease takes everything for me. I'm not someone who relapses a little, takes a bite of something and just, you know, has a few hard days. I lose everything. I cease to want to leave the house at all. And I sometimes won't. And so I have a healthy fear of that. But I also, what really helps me is that I committed, and this isn't in the book, with making 3 outreach calls a day, it's not in the big book, right? They didn't have cell phones then to make it easy. They certainly didn't have apps to make it easy to reach each other. But either way, it's not there. And some people don't need that. But I am grateful that the universe sent me a sponsor that made that a non-negotiable, because I need it. And in those outreach calls, I get a healthy dose of humility when I hear about people's stumblings and whatever they're doing, you know, that are just like mine. And I realized, like, oh God, what have I not done today? I need to do those things. I can't afford to let go of any of this. And so it really helped. The outreach call is kind of the thing that plugs me into everything else. Like whatever God is or the great mystery, I hear it through everyone else's voices. But I also hear it and see, I can see when someone else is talking, like, and I don't know how it happened. I landed in a binge. But we can hear in each other how it happens. We just don't see it in ourselves. And so that kind of the next day when I'm preparing for another trip, because I travel over 50, maybe 75% of the time, as you know, I can't afford not to pack my food. I can't afford not to take my big book. I can't afford not to meet with sponsees or do my 11-step connection with someone. Because for me, it's not that 11-step requires someone else. It's just that I won't do it if I don't have a date with someone to do it. So I do set up a lot of routines, but I keep them because the outreach calls plug me in. And every once in a while, I'll think, I don't need to make another outreach call. At this point, I'm too busy right now. I just can't. And then I like just, to me, however God works, it's that little voice in my brain that says, of course you need to make that call today. And I always hear something that I need to hear. But that's what plugs me into everything else. So I don't know. That's what I got. That's my answer.
Thank you, Nancy. Nick F., your turn.
This is Nick F. in Tennessee. I'm a compulsive overeater. Can I be heard?
Yes,
Nick. I can hear you. Sure.
Thank you, Leah. Oh, my God. Thank you so much, Rena. It really helped me. And I have a question. But I felt I was exactly where I needed to be, where God would have me be as I listened to you. So thank you for saying yes. My question is, I have a new manager at work, and the times that I get to eat have changed. And I was physically ill my last day at work. My sponsor suggested that I call certain people to get their suggestion of what I might do in this experience. And I tell you, I am completely mortified at like just showing up so vulnerable. I feel weak. I actually feel silly and somewhat stupid that I don't have the answer to this. But at the same time, I'm so scared to have to call for this particular matter. Have you ever had a certain issue and you knew what you needed to say in the outreach call and that kind of made it even more difficult to make the call? I hope that makes sense. That's my question. Thank you so much, Darla.
Yeah, thank you. It's good to hear you. Well, for sure, I've been terrified to make an outreach call and ashamed and telling myself the question I have no one's ever had or that's something I'm supposed to get through. And to me, that's just my disease, like telling me I should know it already. You know, I should be able to figure this out, or I can't let anyone know I'm struggling with this. So I don't know how I get through it except for just like I talk back to myself and I'm like, who are you kidding? And also I remind myself that we're all the same. I mean the circumstances are the same. I just mean inside we're all terrified and have things we think no one can help us with. But I also was thinking, you didn't ask about it, but on the meal timing with things changing at work, I've had times where I've been in court and the judge doesn't take a lunch recess or a break, and then suddenly, and I don't know why other people don't need to take a break for lunch, but I know that I eat. If there's a window, I've got a nice, you know, everyone's food plans are different. I'm not suggesting this needs to your window, but it's 4 to 6 hours. It's about the window that I got to get the next meal in, or I start to get, it's not good. You know, I don't know if fully more explain that except for that it's not good. And I have interrupted court to say, excuse me, like I need to eat. I ate my snack in the bathroom. I'm not proud of it, but it was in abstinence and it was done with support on the, you know, in a courtroom bathroom. That there's nothing more important than my taking care of myself, including those meals. Me missing a meal is the equivalent of me snorting a line of cocaine. That's the only way I can think of it. And with that attitude, I'm no longer afraid of asking for what I need in the moment. I don't burden other people. I don't expect other people to provide the meal or other people to take a break then. But I need to eat right now. This is what I need to do without explanation, without drama. I'm not saying that will work for anyone else. I just wanted to share that I have been in these situations where it seemed impossible and I'm spinning and obsessing about what I'm going to do about it. And it's funny, it's all those situations happen to be around food. And then I realized, like, what if, between my partner once asked, what if you had no shame about what you needed to do with food? How would you handle it? It was such a beautiful question. And I've made that my, like, whenever I'm struggling with one of these what to do, you know, moments with food, I always ask myself, what would I do if I had no shame about what I need to do to take care of myself? And the answer gets real clear. So I know you didn't ask about that, but I figured I'd use it as an opportunity to squeeze it in. So thank you.
Thank you, Nick F. Jean M., your question, please.
Yeah, this is Jean M. from Michigan. She answered my question already about the 11th step and about prayer and meditation. So thank you.
Thanks, Jean. Who else has a question for Rena this morning? You can do so by pressing star 1 to unmute. I need your name, including the first letter of your last name.
Leah S.
This is Sarah N.
Sarah M.
Nancy L.
Nancy L.
Anna Yetta.
Elaine S., New York.
Gotcha. Anna Yetta, Elaine S.
Cindy B. in Boston.
Cindy B. Anyone else like to get on this list? Okay, we've got Leah S., Sarah M., Nancy L., Hanietta, Elaine F., and Cindy B. Let's get started. Leah S., go ahead. Leah S., star 1 to unmute.
I'm talking away. Okay, thank you. Thank you, everyone. So as I just said, Renee, what an incredible story. I wonder if you can elaborate on this isolation. How did you actually get out of it? Because, whatever. I am in program, and whether it's mine or sponsees, do you do suggestions or do you make it a must? You got to call me the next hour or something like that. What I've heard, I wonder if you can talk about that. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I thank you. In terms of isolation, when I put the food down and the restriction down, both symptom sides of the same disease, what I felt was like the weight of loneliness. And I heard it as boredom in my head, but what I realized is like boredom is loneliness. Like I really felt lonely. And what I'm grateful for is the discipline of those three calls. I don't mean to keep going back to them, but those three calls started to get me out of isolation. And also the willingness to be like the seventh step, and it's like humbly, like the humility and letting myself be real and messy. Because the reason why I am alone, why I wanted to be alone, why I kept people away without even realizing I was the one keeping people out of my life, I don't even know what, so many millions of ways I'm not going to list, but was that it was exhausting to be with people because I felt like I had to be a certain way to be with people. When it turns out the messier I let myself be with people, the more flawed I let them see how I am, it turns out it's so much easier to be with people. I know sometimes on my 11-step call, that's when I talk to more people, I have more deep conversations. And some people are like, God, you have so much, you're constantly busy with people. Like, how do you take it in, don't you? And I don't get exhausted. I still do need a lot of downtime every day in between being with people, but also when I'm not pretending and I'm not trying to be a certain way or looking like I have it together or feeling like I have something to say, suddenly it's very easy to be with people. It's not draining. It's not exhausting. I'm the same me when I'm alone on my couch as I am with other people. And that's what I strive for. I don't do that perfectly. When I don't, I can often feel icky and tired and want to be alone. And then I just leave, I work the steps and I recommit to being real. So that's it.
Thank you, Leah S. Sarah M., your turn.
Hi, this is Sarah N., as in Nancy, from California. Thank you very much, Renee, for all that you've shared. It's just wonderful. And I'm particularly, I don't think I'll ever forget that image of the scale in your evening bag. And I love the way you say, history has shown. That's such a marvelous phrase for covering the voluminous research and evidence that has been accumulated for why this is what we do. I relate a lot. Sorry, I have a frog in my throat. I relate a lot to your story, and I travel a great deal right now. I'm always packing for another trip, and what after 20 years in OA, but working in the vision level program the past few months, and experiencing a level of neutrality that I haven't experienced before, the question I have for you, and what I want to admit at group level, is that I really have never understood or prioritized outreach calls. I have so many sponsees across several programs that I'm talking to people constantly, and I tell And I text newcomers all the time. And if they call me, I talk to them. But it sounds like you are affirmatively calling people. And is an outreach call, are you calling to see how they are? Or are you calling to just talk about how you are? And there, do you put it into your schedule? Like, this is when I do outreach calls? Because I just don't know how else it would ever happen for me.
I appreciate the specificity of your question, so thank you. Not that all questions have to be specific, but I do have an actual answer to this one. The other ones, I feel like I'm just like, I don't even know what I'm saying, but I could tell you my how-to for this. So I want to note before I do get specific that I don't think our programs all need to look the same. You know, we each have different weight. Like, it just so happens the universe sent me a sponsor that the three outreach calls every day is non-negotiable. You know, like, but everyone has different things. What I hear is something that's working for you and that you have a lot of connection and engagement. And so I'm not telling you what to do or not. I just wanted to acknowledge that what I heard is a very vibrant program that keeps you connected. But for me, the outreach calls, sometimes I have something to share, like I have a 10 step, right? So that's what it is. I'll call somebody. Sometimes I could say, I just put out on a chat one of these, you know, they're not OA approved, but they are these like various apps and things. I just put out like, I'm available for outreach. And then whoever has an issue, they call me, right?
Mm.
And sometimes I put out, I'm available for outreach and no one calls. I'll wait for a few minutes. But the truth is I don't got a lot of time. I'd like to get this done and done too. You know, some days I'm in a rush, especially when I'm traveling. And then I'll just call someone else who's put their name out there and I'll be like, look, I don't really have much to say right now. I'm looking to get my outreach call in, but I'd like us to have a real talk. Let's talk. You know, like literally, I'll talk, I have nothing to say. Let's do a gratitude list. Inevitably, that leads to a deeper conversation unless one of us is in a rush, you know, where it's like, okay. And so sometimes it's a check the box moment. And sometimes it's a deep call that I'm telling someone something I've never told, or someone's telling me something they've never told someone. You know what I mean? Like, it's all different kinds of things. But either way, I do it. So sometimes I call, sometimes I get the call. The most important time is when I'm going to or from an airport. Those transitions, I used to build a relapse in my head without even realizing it years ago, like before this period, this past 4 years. And so I sometimes even save my outreach calls, not that I can't make more, but if I'm busy, I'm like, do in that Uber ride from the airport or in the car ride to the airport, I make outreach calls because it connects me to my program, to everything. It helps me connect before I get home, because often I used to be able to hold myself together on a trip and show up, and then I'd come home and binge all night after making it through, you know, a tough trip. And so now I especially appreciate outreach calls in the transitions of things. So I use transition time as outreach call time. So.
Thank you, Sarah M. Nancy L., your turn.
Thank you. Thanks so much, and thank you, Renee, for your powerful share this morning. What a recovery story. Thank you. My question is, when you're leading someone through the steps, approximately how many times a week do you talk with her or him?
Mm-hmm. Thank you. I want to note my name is Rena, and people have been saying Renee, and I know who you're talking to, so I hate to correct people, but then I realize at least an OA meeting, I should be able to just be able to stand up and say what my name is. So it's okay.
Thanks,
that people
Renee.
Yeah. So it's Rena. So, okay.
Rena.
Yeah. Totally fine. I didn't want any one person to feel bad. Whatever. You guys know we all have these issues, but okay. My name is Rena first. And second, it's such a great question about the details. I always wonder how other people do things. And I have done it so many different ways. My sponsor did it with me where I think we went every day till we got through. Maybe it was five or six. It was at least 5 days a week. And that is my top line behavior responses. But I will acknowledge that that is not how it always has come in practice. In fact, I have one sponsee where it's taken us way longer. she's not available to meet as often as whether she's not spiritually or not schedule available, but it is working for her. So I'm not inclined, when something is working for somebody, I'm not, even though I have my idea of we should be meeting 5 days a week, like that's how it worked for me, something else is working for her. So I know for some people that wouldn't work to even work the program that way. Like, this is how I do it. This is how you do it. But I tell someone what worked for me. We start off that way. And if they lean in a different way and it's working for them, that's the way I go. So sometimes it is 5 days a week, and sometimes it's been twice a week. Sometimes it's been even further than that. And it's, I struggle with it because I'm like, what are we doing? I'm not doing it right. And then I'm like, you know, I'm not in charge. If it's working for someone, I support them. So my top line is five, but that's not often, or not always, not often. It's not always the reality. So
thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you, Nancy L. Hanayeti, your turn.
Rena L. from Ohio. Thank you. First of all, I have not ever heard your story before, so I'm so glad that you were able to do it today. And it's a miraculous story. And wow. So my question. You talked about prayer, and I think the prayers you do are great. I mean, to me, it sounds like prayer. But how did you finally start praying? But really, right now, I have a great program. Thank you, God. But I've just recently started not doing my 11th step in the morning. And I'm not quite making 3 phone calls a day. And I'm really afraid. And yet, I can't seem to get a kickstart to do it again. Do you have any kick in the pants information that you can give me?
I have some magic keys.
Maybe.
And I should note, my full name is Klan. My full name is Klan Arena. So I'm especially pleased to hear
Klan
it. Just after
Arena.
I think it's great that just after I said my name, Rena, it's funny that you were the one to share. I'm like, oh, now we'll go with my full name. Okay, this is good. But it's a great question. And I know that there's probably deeper spiritual answers than what I'm about to tell you. But around December this year, I was starting to like really do the bare minimum and barely the bare minimum. And I was starting to talk myself into thinking I was saying I was doing things that if you have to like explain to yourself what you're not doing, that it's kind of like it, it's almost close to it. Like, oh, I bumped into someone in the program. That counts as an outreach call or whatever craziness I had going on. I'd stopped like, oh, I'll just do one. If I just do 1 minute of closing my eyes while I'm in the shower praying, that counts, you know, like just, which of course it counts. It's not a bad thing, but I need more. And so I did something that would not work for me pre-recovery, pre-abstinence, any kind of work for me, it doesn't work for me. When I'm in the food, I am immune to lists and to-do lists. Like, they've got nothing. But in recovery, I decided to just make a list of all the recovery practices I need to do each day. And I made it a chart. And this makes me feel like I'm 6 years old. But here we go. This is all about humility. I put a check next to each thing right now. And I've been doing it since December. All throughout the day, for each 3 calls, for each time when I prayed and meditated, when I did my 11th step, and I check it off, and somehow those checks help me make sure I get done every day. Is that the most spiritual way to live one's life? I'm not sure that it is, but I had gotten off track. I was starting to get off track, like what you're talking about right now, and it terrified me. And so I think that making the chart was me setting the intention of who I really want to be and who I need to be. This is how important it is to me and the deeper sense. And so it's not like being this perfect, checking all the boxes is what matters, but it does allow me to not lie to myself and say, well, I kind of did it. I don't check off the box until I actually did it. Because my disease tells me a lot of stories to make me feel okay about not doing something. So that is, I'm living under the wrath of my own checklist, and I'm delighted right now. But I want to note that wouldn't have worked for me if I was in the food. No checklist is getting me out of the food. But here in abstinence, looking to nudge myself back into good recovery routine, it's been very helpful. So I don't know why I'm more embarrassed about this checklist than telling you that I slept with strangers to avoid binging on food, but there you go.
Thank you very much. I am going to nudge myself into making that chart today.
Nice.
Thank you, Hanayeti, for your question. Elaine F., your turn.
Hi, this is Elaine S. from New York, and thank you so much, Rena. I just so appreciate your share and the questions that were asked and the discussion, and Leah, thank you all so much. What I want to ask you about is black and white abstinence. How black and white is your abstinence? And connected to that for me is behaviors. What food behaviors are a problem for you, and how do they relate to your black and white abstinence? Are you abstinent, black and white abstinent with your behaviors as well as your food? Thank you so much.
Yeah, it's a great question. Whatever the phrase black and white means, I know that my abstinence is, it's black. I mean, I don't know exactly what that means, but I do know that my abstinence is very, I want to be clear about something that was reversed. My definition of abstinence for me, this isn't the OA definition. There is an OA definition, and I'm engaged with that definition. I include that as part of my definition. But the other piece to me is that I abstain from hurting myself with food. All the everything else that you're talking about, black and white, all that, that's how I know I'm not hurting myself with food. So I have no way of knowing, because I trick myself a million ways. And so it is, so when I say black and white abstinence, but what I really mean is I have a black and white food plan for me. And other people have, it's all the same definition. And so my food plan, you know, looks like I have a food plan that was made by someone that wasn't me. In my case, I needed someone that both knows about food addiction but also restrictive eating disorders, who created a food plan that provides me enough but also doesn't have any of my trigger substances. That's not for everyone else. Everyone, it just needs to be the opposite of other, you know, my disease. It has set amounts. I know what I'm going to eat before I eat it because I committed to my sponsor the night before. I don't eat between meals no matter what. When I measure food, I measure food on a scale no matter what. What else? That's part of that. But as part of that, I also don't eat any foods that are light or non-fat or anything like that, because my restriction side really loves to be on a diet. But on the other side, my disease really likes things like big sugary treats, you know, and so I abstain from both. But my abstinence is also black and white in that I abstain from being underweight. Because when I'm underweight, I'm on an elevator down. I abstain from certain kinds of exercise. In fact, all exercise that raises my heart, because I get hooked on it. And so I abstain from being compliment skinny. I abstain from diet and fitness magazines of all kinds. So to me, it needs to be black and white, because I can't handle gray when it comes to this. But I also know that what I do doesn't need to be the same for anybody else. Everyone who I sponsor, everyone I know, our food plans and the behaviors we need to abstain from are different. So I don't know if that's helpful, but it's what I do.
Thank you so much. Definitely helpful.
Thank you, Elaine F., for your question. Cindy B., your turn.
Hi, thank you all so much for your service, and it was beautiful to talk to you. I'm Cindy, recovered bulimic and compulsive overeater in the Boston area. I'm really grateful to be on this meeting today. My question is this. I got into OA when I was in my 20s, and my daughter was very much affected by my bulimic behaviors and in her life. Now she's in her 40s. There's a lot of concern about her health, and this year especially noticed her weight going up, and she's got diverticulitis and has been hospitalized for that, and she has a lot of issues around food, but she has a lot of trauma around it as well, because of being a daughter growing up, you know, in a household where I was acting out so violently in a way with food. And you talked about your friend that you just saw, and you said it was 15 years and she finally asked you for something. And my question really has to do with, when do you know what to say, what not to say? I really haven't said anything to my daughter. I don't feel like I am even probably the right person, but also entitled to even say anything because of you know, what I put her through too, and, you know, but she does see what I do. So I just was wondering if you had any experience, strength, and hope around, you know, dealing with people you love dearly that are hurting themselves with food. Thanks.
Mm-hmm. It's a beautiful question, because what I hear so much is the love you have for your daughter, and that probably matters more than anything, you know, at least in my, this is just my humble opinion. I'm not an expert in these matters, but what I do hear is how much you love her. And I don't know that I'm always the best, that it's my voice that should be help, like that I might not be the person that can carry the message to somebody because of our relationship. Like my sister, who's over 150 pounds overweight when she was, that she couldn't hear the message from me. And even though she's seen what I do over the years, she knows why I do it. I've mentioned the name of the program I go to just to see if there's interest, but there isn't. And she couldn't hear it from me. She might hear it from a friend or somebody else. You know, I know she knows other people in the fellowship. But to me, it's more of a, like, accepting the things I can't change. And this is not my place. Like, I don't know your life situation. What I know is no matter, my mother was, my mother certainly tried to control my food. And my mom was emaciated for much of my life. And it certainly contributed, I'm sure, to my relationship with food or how my symptoms played out. But I am clear that I was born with this thing. No one created it. Not even my mom and her disease was powerful enough to create this disease in me, nor is she powerful enough to take it away from me. But my parents' love and care has built inside a structure, an architecture, that eventually made me want to save myself. So I don't know the technical answer, you know. I know that there's some people who give talks about how to kind, you know, attraction rather than promotion, like how to, you know, introduce the big book to someone. I'm just not sure that I ever, no matter what my mom says, as much as I love her, if I ever could hear the message from her. But I do, so yeah, I'm going to stop with that. So I'll be thinking, though, of you and your daughter. So.
Thank you, Cindy B. We still have time for additional questions. If you have something on your mind you'd like to pose to Rena, you can do so by pressing star 1 to unmute. I need your name, including the first letter of your last name.
Mrs. Okay. Sally W.
Sally W. Was there somebody
Kate.
Else?
Kate.
Judith.
Barbara P.
Kate, from New Hampshire.
Judith R. Barbara P.
Kate P.
Yes, Kate, I do have you. Thank you. Anyone else? This is the final call for questions.
Debbie B. from Virginia.
Debbie B. Okay, that's a great list. Let's begin with Sally W., followed by Kate P. Go ahead, Sally. Sally, star 1 to unmute.
Thank you. May I be heard?
Yes.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you, Karina. Your share really resonated. I'm Native American, and so the Great Mystery is something that resonates with me a lot. So I've been actually fired as a sponsor and somewhat criticized because I do believe that while the program has, you know, the mothership, the program has guidelines, et cetera, that are, you know, through the Big Book and other approved program materials. My program has a lot of things in it in addition to that. And I sponsor in a way where I don't, you know, criticize someone's food. I basically say what works for you while also leaning into the principles. So I was just curious if my specific question is, do you have specific sponsees or your sponsor who understands your way of doing program for you as opposed to kind of a, canned, I don't want to say cookie cutter approach, no pun intended, but it's like Is my question clear? Is my question clear, Karina?
Yeah. Thank you. It's a good question.
Thank you.
My sponsor. This is my belief. This isn't like, it's just my own belief. But my belief is that the universe, the great mystery, whatever it is, sends us each the kind of sponsor we need at that particular time. And so I needed a sponsor and need a sponsor who is very specific and really believes to do, if you want what I have, you do what I do. And so I do exactly the things she made as non-negotiables in a written document on day one. I still do those things. And when I stray and I look for her support in straying, that is not what I get. I get like, who are you kidding? We know who you are. Do what you do. Like, do these things. But that is not the way I sponsor. I tried and it doesn't work for me. That doesn't mean it won't in the future. I have no idea. But apparently whoever gets sent to me needs someone to say, like, I support you however you, like, I'm letting you know what works for me and I support you however you want to do this, you know? And I don't comment on their food unless they ask me for feedback. Not what I do. I let them know I make 3 outreach calls, and if they agree to do it, I'll say, you know, if I see they aren't, you know, if I see that they aren't, then when they don't commit it for a day, I'll check in and say, you're missing outreach calls. And if they say that they're not wanting to make them, I'll say, you know, that doesn't work for me, but I'm not dropping them because of it. I'm not going to make them because I don't know what their journey is. There's a lot of things that they've done that my program cannot sustain, you know, including that they don't weigh and measure their food, but my sponsor does and I do. And I can't get away without doing it. Whatever means get away with. I don't even know what that means. It just means I need to do it. But for someone else, that's not what their program needs. At least that's my belief. So I'm not saying I'm doing that right. I'm not even sure if my sponsor agrees with how I do it with other sponsees, but at all, actually. I know she does it quite different. And yet I'm okay with all of that. You know, so that I might need one thing, but I might need to give something else. Or maybe I'm only capable of giving something else for today. So,
thank you, Sally, for your question. Kate P., your turn.
Thank you so much, Rena, for your talk. It was absolutely amazing, and I will listen to it again. You kind of said you've relapsed before, and my question is about, you know, because you have said that, you know, your spiritual was, you know, gradual learning what works for you. Was it the same way with your relapses, is that you needed to figure out, okay, I can't do that because when I do that, this happens. And, you know, so is that how your program was built? So that's my question about relapse.
Yeah. I do have a long and sordid tale of relapse, that's for sure, in this fellowship and with the food and restriction and binging. I do believe that just like recovery is, just like the disease is progressive, recovery is progressive also. So I certainly learned, I don't believe everyone needs to relapse, and we certainly don't need to relapse to learn lessons about our disease. But that apparently was my path, you know, and I did learn things from each relapse about the depths of my disease and my powerlessness, or learning finally that using a food plan in the service of the restrictive side of my disease always leads me back to binging. Like learning that fact, except for that I went through that pattern 5 times before I learned it. So. To say that I learned, you know, I did learn different levels of humility. One period of relapse, I learned that I was going to have to believe that I was loved and worthy of joy and pain and the full human experience at any size. So I put weight on really rapidly really rapidly. And I didn't want to leave the house and I had no clothes that fit and I didn't want to get clothes that fit. And I was becoming deeply shut in, and even before I got out of the food, I decided I was going to believe that I was worthy of love. And it's funny to say light, right? Right now at the topic of my talk, and light at every size. And that lesson I learned in relapse. It was taking what I learned in program and that I'd talked to so many other people about. And that wasn't loving myself into the disease. It was loving myself when I was in the disease, and that was the only way I was going to get out, was to start walking out and being in life and wear clothes at that size that made me feel okay at that size, that beating up on myself was not going to get me out of this disease. It has never gotten me out of a state of relapse to beat myself up. I already beat myself up with the food. What did I need to beat myself up for eating the food right after? So I did learn things along the way. That's for sure. I don't know if I don't believe I needed to relapse to have learned them, but that's the path that's happened. So, yeah, that's it.
Thank you so
much. Thanks, Kate. Thank you for your question. Judith R., your question, please.
Thank you so much, Hannah Rina. Thank you for a powerful story. I'm wondering how many sponsees you tend to take at the same time.
Mm-hmm. So all the caveats I have. I know people do it differently, do way more. Or different, not more, but I only take one person through the book at a time. It sometimes overlaps. I think someone's done and then it turns out like they're gone and then like they come back, you know, or something like that happens. So maybe it's two and I'm in two fellowships. So sometimes that gets a little like dicey, but generally speaking, my goal is only one person at a time through the book. And then once somebody is recovered, when that happens, then I meet with them either once a week or I do a Zoom with a couple of sponsees. Two of them I'll meet with later tonight, actually, when I fly back home, and we'll meet at late night for me on Eastern time, that I meet with and we check in. And sometimes we read program literature together, like we did the big book stories, that we did the law stories of the big book. Now we're in some other program spiritual literature. Way to stay in touch. And I know some people sponsor way more. And I really, this is what I can handle without feeling overwhelmed. So I'm grateful to have the boundary of that. But maybe it'll be more in the future. But for today, I just take one person through the book at a time. And then my goal is to sustain a relationship with them where we're part of each other's lives.
Thank you, Judith R. Thank you. Barbara P. Star 1 to unmute.
Hi, my name is Barbara P. I'm a compulsive overeater from New Hampshire. Thank you for your share. I live in a part of the country where we absorbed a really heavily tool-based program from Massachusetts. And for the first 20 years I lived here, that was sort of the goal. People, you know, doing the tools was what was going to keep you abstinent. Over time, we've moved to a much more step-based model, and I didn't hear a whole lot of, you know, what the source of your power is. I think people can mistakenly get the idea that the tools have the power, and I would like some idea of what you conceive of as your source of power. Is it the steps? Is it your sponsor? Is it something else? And how do you how do you reach for that when you need it? Thanks.
Yeah, it's a good question. I know that of my own power, like on my own, that my disease wins every time. Like every single time. So I definitely need some power that's greater than me. Sometimes, as a result of just showing up for the practice, I believe that there is a power out there that I can tap into that takes it for me, takes away the compulsion, takes away the obsession, and helps me show up in life the way I never thought I could, in ways I never even knew to hope for. And sometimes I don't connect that at all. It feels like there's nothing there. And that's when I'm grateful that I have the discipline of the tools and that I've made it like the drumbeat, like the quiet drumbeat of my life that gives it like a daily that I need. And sometimes the way I work those tools helps me see that power. When I hear someone else talking and I see something in their life that's different than when I talked to them the last time, or some spiritual shift, I'm like, oh, there is a universe that, like, something bigger than us, you know? And so my faith wavers. It's there and it's not there. And the tools fill the spaces in between that, those in there. But sometimes working the tools, it's not that I think the tools are it. Jeff, I agree that working the steps unblocked me from having access to power, and it helped me access power. But the tools sometimes help me get there when over time that wavers. And sometimes the power is in the group, you know. Sometimes, this is so silly, but I have a 9-foot teddy bear that lives in my closet now. It moved in when I first got abstinent. It was random timing. But that 9-foot bear, it's not some golden path moment, but sometimes it reminds me, because it's so much bigger than me and it's so fluffy and soft, that sometimes I could imagine a power greater than me that is like vulnerable and soft and loves the soft and vulnerable parts about me. And so sometimes that's what works, you know, something visual. So I can't believe I just mentioned my teddy bear on this line, but there you go. All right. I'm available for another question.
Thanks so much, Barbara P. And our final question for the morning comes from Debbie B. Your question, please, Debbie.
Hello. Thank you so much, Layla. Thank you, Rena. Thank you from my heart to the both of you and all who make this possible. Kind of a two-part question. In your worst cycling of relapse, how did you surrender? What did you do to put the food down so that you could have the clarity to work the steps? And then that person who helped you, your sponsor, how did they do it? So how can how can we help fellows in relapse? Thanks so much.
What a beautiful question. Thank you. So this last go-round, and I only have today, and I think that's all any of us have, but the last time I got free from this disease, I actually wasn't working yet with my current sponsor. I was working with a sponsor who I talked to every day, but while I was deep in the food, I was still reaching out to her. And one morning, I woke up ready to, my first act was to order DoorDash or Uber Eats or whatever it is. I binged all night. I woke up and I was like, I'm not even bothering committing to not binging today. Like, screw it. I'm just going to do it. And I forgot that we had a call scheduled, and the phone was like, my cell phone was ringing, and I was like, I'm not answering it. I'm ordering this food, because if I pick up the phone, I'm going to be tortured about ordering this food, as if I wasn't already torturing myself. And then I was like, oh, something made me pick up the phone. And I said, I'm ordering food. I just want you to know. I don't want to talk now. I just don't want to be rude and not show up for the call, you know? And she said, can you text me in 3 hours? Just for 3 hours. Well, I'm going to tell you that for the next 2 months, I texted her first for a few weeks, her every 3 hours. And I started to feel silly, not silly, but guilty or taking up too much space in her phone. So I came up with the idea, why don't I assign a different friend in recovery a different day of the week? And they were going to get texts from me every 3 hours that they didn't need to respond to. And I asked several people to do it. And I kept that up for a couple of months, every 3 hours, and somehow that I got abstinent that way. I didn't binge those 3 hours, and then I made it the next 3 hours, and the next 3 hours, and the next 3 hours. I wasn't working the steps. I mean, we were talking about the steps, but we weren't like going through the big book. That wasn't happening. And then one day she told me painfully that she had been in relapse and didn't want to tell me, because she was so miraculous that I was able to put the food down, and she didn't want to throw me off. Which was such a loving act, because I knew how painful it was for her to show up, because I know how painful it is to show up in this disease. And so I said, I love you. We're still going to talk once a week. As a matter of fact, I just saw her here in Chicago 2 days ago, which was delightful to be with her. But I said, tomorrow morning, I'm going on that crazy vision meeting where those crazy big book thumpers are, these crazy recovered people, and whoever puts their name out first for sponsorship, I'm asking them to sponsor me. And that is how I started working with my current sponsor. All I have is to share with my experience. So hopefully there's something in there that's helpful to hear.
Thank you, Debbie, for your question. Thanks to all who posed questions this morning. And of course, thank you so much, Rena, for your time and sharing your experience with all of us. It's truly been profound and inspiring. Such a delight. Thank you very much. Mm. The share ID for today, 23,446. That's 23446. We're going to close now from page 164, found in a chapter entitled A Vision for You. Our book is meant to be suggestive only. We realize we know only a little. God will constantly disclose more to you and to us. Ask him in your morning meditation what you can do each day for the man who is still sick. The answers will come if your own house is in order. But obviously, you cannot transmit something you haven't got. See to it that your relationship with him is right, and great events will come to pass for you and countless others. This is the great fact for us. Abandon yourself to God as you understand God. Admit your faults to him and to your fellows. Clear away the wreckage of your past. Give freely of what you find and join us. We shall be with you in the fellowship of the Spirit, and you will surely meet some of us as you trudge the road of happy destiny. May God bless you and keep you until then.